Welcome to Dear Society Library. I'm Carolyn Waters, I'm a librarian, and I wish you all a very happy Valentine's Day. A little early, but we are really delighted to have these three folks here for this program, A Modern Literary Love Story. Andrew Bonner, Jill Santopoulou, and Wesley Cohen. Let me tell you a little bit about them. Jill Santopoulou is the author of the nationally and internationally bestselling novel, The Light We Lost, which has been translated into 35 languages. Kirkus gave The Light You Lost a star review, and Redbook calls it the epic love story of 2017, and the ending is one you'll be feeling for months to come. And Booklist writes, comparisons will be made to David Nicholson's One Day, but there is something more romantic here, yet also more grounded, that will draw readers in. Jill is also the author of the Alex Flint Mysteries, the Sparkles Foss series, and the Follow Your Heart books. She holds a BA in English Literature from Columbia University, and an MFA in Writing for Children from the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and a certificate in intellectual property law from NYU. I'm talking about that. Ms. Santopoulou is also the editorial director of Philomel Books, an imprint of Penguin Now Readers Group, and an adjunct professor in the New Schools MFA program. Leslie Cohen is the author of the just hot off the press, This Love Story Will Self-Destruct. Her debut novel also got a star review in Kirkus Review, saying that it's an edgy, updated take on Nora Ephron that's full of humor and wit. Booklist writes, When Harry Met Sally for a New Generation, with all the humor, heart, and smarts that writing Neo Ephron entails. So it's not too bad to have everybody comparing you to Nora Ephron. No pressure there. BuzzFeed has listed in its five books that will make you believe in love again, and the New York Post included it in its must-read books feature. Leslie was born and raised in New York, studied fiction at Columbia University, and worked in publishing before becoming an author. And Andrew Bonner is the founder of Bonner Books Literary Agency, which was founded in 1995. He is also the editor of the anthologies Coach, 25 Writers Reflect on People Who Made a Difference, Brothers, 27 Stories of Love and Rivalry, Central Park, Our Boston, The Good Book, Writers Reflect on Their Favorite Bible Passages, and In Their Lives, Great Writers on Great Beatles Songs. He's the co-editor of For the Love of Baseball, a celebration of the game that connects us all. He's a graduate of Collegiate School, Brown University, and the Columbia Business School, a member of Penn American Center and the National Book Critics Circle, and a former intern at Rolling Stone. So please join me in welcoming Andrew, Jill, and Leslie.
In the city that I wholeheartedly recommend that you join this library. And it was at this library 2 years ago, just under 2 years ago, it was actually Leap Day of 2016, where I was working here during the day and I went around the corner because when you have a craving for wildly overpriced produce, there's no better place to go than to Gentilly's Market. And I'm standing online hear this voice saying, I want to murder my agent. And I turn around and there was this person here with whom struck up a great conversation, which led to my representing her, full disclosure, I'm Leslie's agent. So I want to open this up right away to both of you to talk about the theme of the night is modern literary love story. I think all of us studied in school, going back to Shakespeare, unrequited love, unconditional love. It begs the question of how have love stories changed, if they have changed. I got an email from Dan Jones today, who's the editor of the Modern Love section of the Times, which I'm guessing many of you read. It's the most popular section of the paper each week. It seems that there's an insatiable appetite for love stories, but just opening it up and talking about how it relates to your books, but how have love stories changed, and how do they apply to the books each?
going to take this off of here so I don't have to lean so far forward. So since I wrote The Light Lost, which came out this past May, I've been getting a lot of advanced copies of other love stories from editors and from agents to read. And what struck me about all of them, or most of them at least, is that the struggle tends to be about balance, about balancing love and career, love and family, love and kind of all of the other aspects of life. And it made me think that that might be the difficulty of the modern love story, of trying to figure out how what you want from your life in terms of career and in terms of, you know, the kind of mark you want to make in the world balances with wanting love and wanting to support someone else and how you kind of figure out what you're going to do in that situation. So I think that would be, and I think it's kind of a more unique story now than you know, something that you would study as far as an unrequited love or a more classic love trope.
And for people here who don't know, not to put you on the spot, sort of give a brief synopsis of what your book is about, aside from those dazzling reviews that we hear.
Sure. So, The Light We Lost is a story about two people who meet as Columbia College seniors on September 11th, 2001. And their relationship was kind of forged in the crucible of that day, and experiencing that together makes them realize that they want their lives to mean something, they want their lives to matter. And then the story follows them for the next 13 years as they come in and out of each other's lives and pursue their own career dreams as well as trying to figure out how their love will connect.
That segues nicely to start trying to think about what two of you have in common in your books, your work yourselves, and I guess you're both originally from Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Both
went to Columbia?
Yeah.
Both went to law school? No, just the intellectual property.
Yeah,
certificate.
Wise
move.
You both wear multiple hats of other jobs beyond writing books. But Leslie, what Jill talked about, the September 11th connection and having that as a device in the book, and also, can you talk a little bit about what your book is about and how it relates to the theme that we're talking about?
So my book is about, it's similar in that our two main characters, Ben and Eve, they meet at Columbia, but they meet and don't really, they continue to see each other, but nothing really happens between them right away. And then it spans 10 years, and it's sort of an adventure through the streets of New York City. It hops around through different neighborhoods, and you see how these two characters' lives intersect. But also, it's told through the addresses. So my unique take, I guess, on love stories is that I wanted to tell the story through location, which was something that I'd never seen done before. And I guess I was just thinking that locations can be such emotionally resonant parts of any love story. Like, I'm sure if you think about your own relationship and where this happened and where that happened, it's not necessarily like where you got engaged or where you got married, but it's like that bar you were trying to get into and worried that you were underage and wouldn't get in and then the whole night wouldn't happen, and you know, it's like smaller things like that. So
how did we get away? It's coming back to me that was sort of your original take, that it was a love story told through addresses, or New York real estate love story, which I thought was a great hook and idea. How did we get away from that? Do you remember?
Well, it's still there, but I think as I was writing it, it became more about the two of them and what happens, which is good, probably, but I just wanted that backdrop of you know, connects to September 11th because that was the ultimate wrong place at the wrong time. And so for me, I'm not sure that I necessarily went into writing it thinking I'm going to talk about September 11th, but when I was talking about my generation and locations and the city and wanting more, you know, wanting the story to have some substance, there was really no way to get away from that. That was such a place.
Well, and speaking of your generation and something you can't get away from, internet dating. That Dan Jones from Modern Love actually was just on a panel yesterday, I think the title of which was Swipe Left, Have Dating Apps Killed Romance? which I think is a very of-the-moment, resonant topic. Do you want to address that, your thoughts, feelings about
it? Dating apps killed romance. I think dating apps have made it very easy to say no because there's always more people there. So I think it's changed the way people think about love almost in a, it almost commodifies it in a way. Like, it's like, oh, I don't need that black shirt because there are so many other black shirts that might be better. But I do think that once people actually make that romantic connection, love is love is love. I don't know.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think when you think about getting a date with someone back before there were dating apps, it was like you had to meet, and I don't know, it's not that easy to meet someone that you want to go on a date with in your daily life, unless you're in a movie and you're at the library and you pick the book and you're on the other side. Like, sooner that doesn't happen to you, then it's tough, you know? So if you have the dating app and it's easy, it's so much more, people are so much more dispensable. So I think when people are dispensable, it's easier to treat them not as well or as valuable. So.
And the issue of even what we think of when we think of love stories, I think whether it's Romeo and Juliet or Eric Segal, I think there's a classic, conventional, traditional way. At the same time, earlier today, I was thinking my two best friends, basically, who spoke at my wedding 25 days ago to that woman here. And we met in the real world, in the three-dimensional world. Two of the speakers at the wedding they're both filmmakers, and it occurred to me that they describe their films as being about love stories. And they are, I'll tell you what they both are, and they're very different from the sort of Romeo and Juliet. One was a movie called Secretary, which some of you may know is James Spader and Maggie Gyllenhaal, and call it what you want, is an S&M relationship of a kind. People might think it was misogynistic, but it was based on a book, a short story written by a woman, and the screenwriter was a woman. And Steve Sheinberg, who made the movie, was the first to say, it's a love story. It's an unconventional love story, but it's a love story. And the other friends, a guy named Jim Solomon, made a movie called The Witness, which is ostensibly about Kitty Genovese, which you might think, how is that a love story? That's a tragedy. It's a, you know, the story is when it was killed, and the story went that nobody, and then the 38th of her neighbors witnessed it in one form or another and didn't do anything about it. The movie is a documentary, and it's about her surviving brother's search to find out who she was in life, because if anyone knew her, they knew her for the infamous way in which she died. And when he first said, it's a love story, I admit I was a little squeamish, because I thought that sounded almost incestuous or some brother. So I just think it speaks to sort of the, I don't know, everything today seems to be fluid and elastic, but I just think what we call a love story has evolved over time, and as it relates to books, I don't know where we are on the timeline, but there was a moment, or sorry, an extended moment, where there were the pink books, right? The love stories or women's fiction that were all had pink covers. When you were writing your book, did you initially, well, can you talk a little bit about sort of the inception and where it came from, how it evolved? I read the acknowledgement section. And there's a real intense backstory of what you went through to get to this point.
started with a heartbreak. It started because I was in a relationship for 3 years that I thought was going to be the relationship that I was in for the rest of my life, and it kind of exploded in a horrible way that that kind of left me unsure of how to exist in the world, really, because this person that I thought was going to be there forever was no longer there. This future that I thought we were going to have was no longer the future we were going to have. And the only way I could figure out kind of how to cope was to start writing. And up until that point, I'd only written books for children. I'd written 14 books for kids. This is my first book for grownups. Mm-hmm. And I started writing about this other character who was also going through a breakup. And her story wasn't my story, her relationship wasn't my relationship, but through her, I could kind of channel all of the things I was thinking about and feeling. So a lot of people ask me if the book is autobiographical, and while there are sort of scenes that I pulled a little bit from my real life, what I do say is the book is emotionally autobiographical, if not plot by plot autobiographical. And I hadn't really even intended on these chapters being a book. They were just something I was writing, and I had a drink with a friend of mine who writes young adult fiction, and she sort of said, oh, what are you up to? And I said, oh, are you writing anything new? And I said, well, I'm writing Sparkle Spawn number 4, but I'm also working on this thing that I don't even know what it is. And she said, well, why don't you send it to me? And so I sent her 30 pages of whatever I was doing, and she wrote back to me and she said, I think you're writing a novel. I think you're writing a novel for adults, and I think you should keep working on it, because I have felt this way in my life too. And I think that if I can, feel that from these pages, there's a real story here. So I worked on it for 4+ years to get it to be the actual work that it is. But yeah.
And well, I'm sorry for how this might sound trite, but what it begs the question, was it cathartic?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think by 2 years into it, I was like, oh, okay, I can be a human again. And I think, it was a sort of cathartic.
And for those who don't know, the glacial pace of book publishing is from the time you're done with the book, really done and ready for people to buy and read it, it's on average, your publisher as well, I don't know if it's different from my, but it can often be a year. So the emotions that you were having about it, and if you're fortunate enough to have any publicity for the book, and the expectation is the readers have just read it, and you may have written it well over a year. Leslie, do you want to talk a little bit about your trajectory and where this book came from?
I'm not sick of hearing that. So, like all great love stories, my love story arose from a lot of rejection, and not rejection in the romantic form, because I was married at this point, but rejection in the publishing world, just tons and tons. I had written 3 novels before this one that were about various other things, and I very lost, and I didn't know what I wanted to write about next, and what would work and what wouldn't work. And so finally, I just, several mental breakdowns later, just said, okay, like, strip down, what do you want to write about? And I wanted to write a love story, and I wanted to set it in New York City. And that was very clear to me, even though I wasn't sure what the future would hold with it. I just felt instinctively like that was what I really wanted, and if that was what I really wanted, that would be the best product. And in terms of, for me, a love story, I really wanted it to be funny. I felt like there were a lot of funny romantic comedies out there, but not that many funny books that were love stories. I think my mom gave me Goodbye Columbus when I was a little girl, and that was like my beginning of falling in love with love stories, and that was my favorite type of thing, so I thought that was what I would do, and I wanted it to be funny, and I wanted it to be more in the tradition of maybe a romantic comedy than romance.
as an inspiration? Was it on your...
I mean, it's a really good movie, right? So I definitely thought about it, but I think the reason why I'm flattered by that comparison and why I covet it is because it's funny. It's a love story that's funny. It's not necessarily... It's written because Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan are both funny and can be funny. It's written with that in mind, I think. And it's not just about whether or not they fall in love. There's so much about that plot that really doesn't need to be there. Like the fact that Meg Ryan always wants the sauce on the side at the restaurant. It's not really central to the plot that occurs, but I feel like in real life, someone were to ask you, like, why you love your spouse, you wouldn't necessarily list adjectives. You wouldn't say, like, they're so nice, they're so funny. You would have specific little quirks like that, I think, that would mean more to you. So I think someone once gave me the writing advice that you shouldn't include any dialogue that doesn't propel the plot forward, but I think that's kind of bullshit, because I feel like that's not life at all. Like, not everything happens in this perfect, always moving the central plot along. Like, sometimes things are, like, off to the side and quiet and subtle, and they happen, and they mean more to you than big events. So that's why I think maybe the comparison happens because there's, like, some whimsical things that I have. They're just, like, trying to be nice and be like, there's weird stuff in yours and there was weird stuff in When Harry Met Sally, so.
And speaking of Efron's, I don't know if you read the review, or it was a blurb, I guess, from Delia, mm-hmm. Efron. And then also, mm-hmm. have you worked with Amy?
Mm-hmm.
It was another, how many sisters are there? Three, four? Four. And another's a mystery writer, crime writer, and impossible. So, how do you see your work fitting in with the sort of...
With the
Efron's. Yeah, with the Efron's. Or maybe you don't see it at all.
Yeah, I mean, Amy jokes that I can be part of their family because I own leather pants. but yeah, I mean, I think they're all incredibly talented, and I think it's amazing to have four sisters who are so talented at writing in one family. You know, I knew Delia before, and when her book Syracuse came out, which I think is like fantastic, it was one of those books I read the whole thing, and I finished it on an airplane, and then I was like, well, there's 45 minutes left of the flight, and I turned it back to the beginning and I started reading it again. It's just brilliantly crafted, so I was a huge fan of that, so which I like tweeted about nonstop. Then when my book came out, I sort of contacted her and was like, any chance you'd read it?
You mentioned tweeting. I want to get to social media in a bit, but just staying on the topic a little bit. I don't know if you mentioned it, because it's fresh off of Variety that your book, which one is just out in paperback, but it's also just been optioned, and you're going to write the screenplay adaptation.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Told me that the first story you ever wrote was when you were 3 years old.
It was true.
And it was about a cat.
Cat, Stacy the cat. That cat sat on that.
I thought, what happens?
If you pat Stacy the cat, you turn into a mat. That just means now you are a mat, so get out of here. That's the end.
and has it been a straight shit to you? Was
my mother is actually sitting right here, and she laminated it.
Oh.
So I still have it. When I do school visits for my kids' books, I read it to them, and they all just find it's ridiculous that I wrote that.
It would have seemed a lot more ridiculous to me a while ago, but we actually have a three-year-old, and I could see him starting to write something physically, and he's already telling the story. So again, it's a little bit of a cliche question, but like, at what point did you know you wanted to write as a profession?
I mean, I think always. My mom's confirming. I mean, I wrote stories all through elementary school. I wrote stories all through middle school, when you had to write those college essays about, you know, what are you, write page, what, there was one essay like write page 287 of your autobiography or something, and I wrote about myself being at a book signing, signing books. So it's always been something I was interested in, and I wrote through college and I wrote after college.
And I'm just going to indulge my own curiosity. How did becoming a publisher then fit into that?
I think because, I think it was my dad who said, you can't make a living as a writer, you need a job.
Yeah.
And I had interned at a children's publisher when I was in college, and I just sort of fell in love with the entire way that you can mix art and text, and the idea of introducing kids to stories you might not, you know, have loved reading before, and now they read this book, and it's the one that makes them fall in love with reading. I don't know if I've ever read anything you know that's happened with, but it's the dream, at least.
And Liz, do you remember the first story you ever wrote, or when you sort of got the bug, or thought this is something I'm going to do, or try to do, at least?
I remember, do you guys remember Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, so that was a big deal when I was a kid, and I remember getting one that had a fill-in-the-blank, where you said like it was like ad libs and it had a little blank every other word and you were supposed to put the adjective. I remember just writing like long sagas and all these line things, like there was no white space on the page because I had taken this opportunity to talk about my feelings in great depth to nobody who was listening. But it was like they wanted a one word answer and I was really pontificating very, very strongly on this. I always wanted to be a writer. I just didn't know whether I could actually put it into action. So, hence law school detour. It's a really expensive, really pain in the ass detour. I don't recommend it to but.
And since you, I mean, your book, you write about literally about young adults in the literal sense of it, right? Did you ever, we never talked about this, did you ever think about, well, one whether this love story will self-destruct could be for a younger audience, or did you ever think about writing for that audience?
Yeah, I did, and I still think maybe I could do it at some point. But I liked the idea of writing about people in their 20s, 20 to 30. A little younger feels a little removed from me, but. Yeah, I think maybe it could happen. I don't know.
Jill, you've done both. I mean, it's probably the question you get asked as much as anything else, so maybe you're tired of it. But I think people are curious sort of how, I mean, you've got sort of quadrants. You've got the writing life, the publishing life, the adults and the young adults. I mean, how do you, have you had story ideas or book ideas where you actually are not sure what the market is, or do you not even have to, you not bother yourself with thinking in those terms, and you can sort of demagogic about it. You just write it and then let an agent or a publisher tell you your market is.
Well, I mean, I never really intended to write for adults. My intention for my whole life was to stay in the children and young adult sphere, which I really enjoy. And in that situation, you know, when your headspace is, I'm writing about a 10-year-old super sleuth, you know who the audience is. Or when you think, okay, I'm writing a 14-year-old choose-your-own romance story. You know who that audience is. You know, there's no real chance of crossing it, you know, up or down.
Is that a function of today? I mean, it's almost a similar, well, the evolution of what is a love story. Do you think, there are people who will say, if Tetra the Rye was published today, it would be white adult, but I mean, the mores have changed sort of what children's sophistication or maturation, has that evolved as far as?
Yeah, I mean, though there is a big chunk of books that are in the young adult sphere that are crossovers, I think. I mean, even if you think of something like The Fault in Our Stars by John Green, which so many adults have read, or, Stephanie Meyer, Twilight, so many adults read.
So there was some story that it was grandmothers, mothers, and daughters, like all weekends, or how do you get that? It's just, you know, I don't think you can try to write for it, right? There's just something universal or transcendent that just happens.
Yeah, and I think sometimes like they cross up and sometimes they cross down, you know? I mean, the American Library Association gives the Alex Award for adult books that they think teenagers would really, really like. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that there are some, there's that space in the middle that where books can find an audience either way. I think the main difference, though, tends to be that if a book is written from an adult point of view, even if the narrator or the character, main character, is a teenager, then it ends up being published for adults, but if it's more immediate, then it ends up being published for teens.
Yeah, like Rainbow Rowell, Eleanor and Park, I think of that. That's one of my favorite love stories, and it's YA, and even though it's about high school kids, it's just written so in such a sophisticated, beautiful, classic way that I just don't even care, you know?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of adults read that one and loved it. A lot of my friends, my 30-year-old friends, are reading that and love it. So I think it just depends.
And she also writes books that are targeted for adults.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
How important do you think it is, whether it's a love story or not, let's keep it within that realm, that the characters are relatable? I mean, as an agent, I've submitted work to publishers, and they like the story, they like the telling, but they say it's not credible in the sense of, like, why is she with that guy? Doesn't she, and who has not sort of made that choice? So there's another realm of it where, as an agent, if I work with somebody who, it can be race, gender, religion, I can tell that somebody thinks, we might work well together, but since you don't walk in my shoes, you're not in my skin, you can't really relate and get all the nuance of it. I mean, do you write with an eye toward or a thought toward who your readers are? Or as a reader, do you think in terms of, I want to see some elements of myself, I want someone who's relatable, or I want something outside of my experience because my everyday life is wherever you want to go?
Totally depends on mood. I feel like I sway back and forth. Sometimes I go to the bookstore and I want to relate immediately to everything, and I don't want to, it seems so tedious to go on like a fantasy trip somewhere. But then sometimes I feel like I'm completely sick of myself, sick of my friends, just want an escape. So I feel like it really depends. But with my book personally, I feel like my strength is making it relatable. I don't have the greatest imagination. Some of these fantasy authors, I read their stuff and I'm like, how did you come up with that? That's so crazy, you know? I'm just better at things that are, you would recognize on your way to the subway or at work or with your friends and relationships. So I feel like it's more in my strength zone to try to be relatable.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because one of the books that I love the most that I read later than most people, but I read it this past year, was Americana, the Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie book. And a lot of the book takes place in Nigeria. And I've never been to Nigeria. I don't know what it's like in Nigeria. But I felt like I could relate to Ifemelu on a sort of human level, on the way she feels about her family, the way she feels about her friends, the way she feels about school, the way she feels about her future. And I think that when I really like a book, the trappings of it don't matter. The where of it doesn't matter, that whether it's fantasy or real doesn't matter. But if I can feel that human connection, I can relate to that character.
And by the human connection, again, doesn't have to fit any of your own demographics.
No, as long as I can understand what that person's feeling.
I feel like it comes down to voice a lot of the time for me. It's like the voice of the narrator. I don't care where they are in the same way. Like, I don't care where they are, what they're doing. If I've never been to that place, it's really just if their voice speaks to me on a human level.
Not the voice or something, I'm just remembering my first date with my wife, I mentioned my interest in dwarfs and in Tourette syndrome, which is not your usual first date fare. And I think would have sent a lot of people to the bathroom if he never had come back. But there's a reason. It's not for the voyeuristic. It's not the freak. It's none of that. It's just there's something metaphoric, whether the dwarfs is about, well, we all feel small in the world, and Tourette's is about inhibition and involuntarily doing things that, you know, where's that line of control? So I cringe a little bit when I see, because the book business is very small c conservative, like conventional, you're in it. So I think, and there's a lot of kind of, there's commercial and there's literary and there's women's fiction and there's this, and I just think it's a little bit over simplified in that way. And I want to just, how are we on time? Okay. So can't not talk a little bit about something that came up before, which is social media and the role of social media in writing. It's sort of shocking to me in a way, but naive not to understand that I think people who are writers today, whether you think of it this way or not, you're expected to be, you don't have to think of it as self-promoting, but it's not enough. There's an expression in basketball, shooters shoot. Meaning, if you're a good shooter, that's what you should do and stick with that. Don't try to handle the ball. So the quaint idea and antiquated idea, I guess now, is that writers write. And you both know, and some of you may know, that's hard enough. But that's also not enough in the eyes of, right? And the publishers and even your publicist will expect you to be the one to write, to tweet or be on Facebook or, you know, maybe do events like this or just sort of get your name. I mean, how do you, is that your perception of it? And if it is, how do you feel about it?
I just want to write and then crawl under my couch, never talk to anyone. But people tell me, like my agent, my publicist, that that's not a good idea. So I'm in the world, like it or not. But yeah, I mean, it's hard because you do have to self-promote, and that's not what I'm comfortable with. A lot of writers are pretty introverted, so I don't know. I think you just have to find the balance of putting your stuff out there, telling people to buy it, and not alienating everyone you know somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, I don't know if it's like a celebrity culture or something, but there's something where like people are interested in not just the creation, but also the creator. And that's kind of, I think, what the social media Twitter thing is. So
that's provocative to me, because I don't think there's any question it's a celebrity culture, like to an extreme, to an awful extreme. But I also think you're right that, and I'm one of the people who's interested in the creator, but not because of celebrity or fame, but it's just the same way, it's sort of, how does this, it's a kind of curiosity. Or anatomizing, and other people, I mean, I've worked with at least one writer who just said, I don't want my author photo on the book. And I said, why? It was a short story collection. And she was insistent because she didn't want the reader to know anything about, you may notice with fiction, more than nonfiction, sometimes the acknowledgments, if there are any, are just very brief, or it's just a list of names, or not at all. And it took me a long time to notice that and then realize part of the reason is there's a certain type of fiction writer who just wants to say, you don't know me and I don't want you to know me.
And it shouldn't matter.
I mean, one of my muses is Charles Schulz of Peanuts fame, and he could have written his autobiography anytime he wanted and people would have backed up the trunk for him, but he just said, anything I have to say, I say through my characters.
I feel like you have to be really famous to pull that off.
A lot of people are really, and for whatever reason, very interested. I mean, I've been invited to people's book clubs now, a lot of people's book clubs, and most of the questions, I mean, I'd say they're split 50-50 about my characters and what's going to happen next to them and why they made decisions that they made, and then also about me and what parts of the story or similar to my life or what this relationship was like or that relationship was like or have I ever been here or there or this other place that I wrote about in the book.
They want to know about process also. It's dating myself, but I feel like for a while there was always a question, do you write with a pencil or typewriter or word processor?
I haven't got any of those.
Do you go to an office during the day, at night, get out of your pajamas?
I have not gotten any of those questions. They all want to know, like, so did your ex come to your book events?
Yeah, the number one question everyone asks me is, Ben like your husband? That's what they all want to know. And they assume Eve is me, like without me having to say anything. That's just assumed. But they want to know, is Ben my husband? Am I married? Do I have children? And I always say, Ben has some qualities of my husband, but he's not quite exactly my husband. And they all give me this look like, Nobody believes me. And I'm like, here's his number, call him. He doesn't know anything about structural engineering. He's a structural engineer. But, you know, it's nice that people feel like it's real, I think, and I don't want to burst their bubble and tell them it's not real. Like, let's just go on the ride, and Ben's my husband, and sure, you know.
People sometimes slip when they ask me questions. I'm like, so when you were in Turkey, and I was like, And I mean, I did go to Turkey. So I was like, yeah, and they're like, and you went to, like, this such and such place, and Darren said, I was like, oh, you're not actually talking about me going to Turkey, you're talking about my character going to Turkey, okay.
This is a book that I worked on. I didn't know when it came out. It's called At Expectations, and it's by a woman named Kit Reed, who sadly died a few months ago. It was my brother's writing teacher at Wesleyan. But I don't know if you can see it, but it's a picture of two, would you say mice? Two computer mouses. And the book came out in 2000, and she taught an online-only writing class. And I also realized I skipped over, today is the birthday of one of the great writers of all time, and I have a prize, speaking of love, and it's a book called Heart of the City, Nine Stories of Love and Serendipity on the Streets of New York. If anyone can tell me whose birthday this is, what great literary lion.
Hemingway.
No. He's associated, he would be 206.
Oh.
Still alive, and he's associated with the times. He was the best of times. So we still have time. Maybe you can open up to questions, and then that'll lead to some other things that you want to talk about. Yes.
My associations with older romance would be like unrequited love, and I never understood why, like, you know, Romeo and Juliet, spoiler, you know, Dr. Zhivago, all those things, and I don't really see why that's romantic, but what is the essence of romance? What do you find to be one of the qualities that are at the essence of romance?
Not just because of the ending, but also it just felt like they didn't really know each other that well. There's like no real connection between them. They say like one word to each other, and then all of a sudden it's assumed that they cannot live without each other, and there's a house divided. And I feel like with a lot of classics, a lot of classic love stories like that, the connection between the two characters is like a blip. And then you're supposed to assume they can't live without each other, and then all this other stuff happens. Whereas I feel like more modern love stories try to have like at least one conversation between and that's maybe an aspect of modern stories that are a little bit more realistic than the classics. And I like that more. I like to see more of a connection, at least one, two conversations tops before they know they have to be together forever. But in terms of what, I don't know, I mean, what's the essence of romance? Was that the question, Mr. Eskenazi?
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, they're actually knowing each other, whereas
room, yeah. I feel like that's more of a classic, more of an old-fashioned thing.
Yeah. You know, I wonder if part of the romance of Romeo and Juliet is just the idea of some emotion that I do agree you're just supposed to assume is there. But some emotion that is so strong that it makes you go against your family and it makes you go against the expectations that are there for you. So I think there's something about the strength of emotion or the power of that emotion in romance throughout the ages that, you know, that there's a connection deep enough that it makes you want to change your life or change your world or change the expectations that someone has for you. I don't know. I haven't really thought about it other than that just 5 minutes now. So, but that's my answer.
Yeah, I'll just only add that, I don't know, it seems like maybe it was only 3 years ago, a friend of mine was married and had a couple of kids who were on the way to growing up. So in some contexts, said, you know, there's something very romantic about raising a child together. Meaning, the feelings that he had that engendered between him and his wife. And at that point, I just nodded. I was happy for him that he felt that way after, you know, however many years of marriage. And you know, I took him at his word. And now I'm experiencing that. And there is something. I don't know that that's something that has changed over time. It's just something either you experience and feel, or you don't. And the only other thing I think that provokes is going back to the Nora Ephron and the Harry Met Sally, and you know, the confliction thing. And I think there's some people who infer that two people meet, and if they're just at odds, that maybe that means that they like each other, or mm-hmm. that they're right. But I don't understand that.
Can you talk about some of the central conflicts that you wrote for your characters and the choices that they made, especially the choices more so, and how you wrote those choices and why those were important to you? And also maybe without giving away spoilers at the end, how did you come to write the ending of the stories and, you know, the choices leading to the ending? Because the endings were
So I think someone once gave me the writing advice, torture your protagonist. So anytime like something started feeling too good, I was like, oh, we've got something bad has to happen. Got to throw something terrible in there. Ratchet up the tension, kind of. But I think the central conflict is really, you know, this is maybe sound like a really lame central conflict, but it's like priorities almost. It's like, what's more important to you in your life? And is it the ambition that you have, or the desire that you have to create something or make something? Is it stability? Is it a family? Is it all of that? Or is it passion and adventure and excitement, and can those live hand in hand? Which I guess is kind of what I was writing about in that book. So whenever the answer seems to be one, I would throw something in that would make it seem like maybe the answer is the other, to try and, you know, build that in a different way. And as far as the ending of my book, at least, it actually almost came out of the narration. Because when I started writing the book, it's written in the first person with a second person address. So it's an I writing to, speaking to a you, and I started writing it that way because I was trying to capture the way it feels when you're in a relationship with someone and you just, at least I start sort of thinking throughout the day, like, oh, I'm gonna tell them this or remember that or do this, and that person is always in your mind, so that when they're not there anymore, you know, you can still be talking to them, but they're never going to know what you were saying. So I wrote the story to try and capture that intimacy with this narration. And when I gave the first, you know, 50 or 100 pages or something to a writing group I'm in, and my friend Marie said, well, why is she talking to him? I'm like, I don't know. She just is. It's it's this thing I wanted to do. And she's like, well, that's lovely, but you need a reason. So I came up with these whole, like a string. I was like, well, maybe it's because of this. And she's like, that's a dumb reason. I was like, maybe it's because of this. And she's like, yeah, that's not satisfying either. And then I was like, well, maybe it's because this is how it ends. And she's like, yes, that's how it ends. Do that. It was hard to write, and I ended up shifting where it ended, like pages earlier, pages later, kind of trying to figure out exactly what the right point was. It wasn't an easy ending to it exactly right.
I think for me, the hardest part about writing this was that I really wanted it to be a love story that was totally predictable and cliche. And I had seen so many times in other love stories that there's this device in the middle, like you put them together, and then there's something that pulls them apart, but it doesn't pull them apart so much so that they can't get back together fairly quickly. So it has to be an obstacle. There's always an obstacle that comes up that makes it all the more sweeter when they get together in the end. And I thought, God, isn't there a way around this? It's so obvious. It seems so clear that this obstacle is thrown in. And then all of a sudden, she has this, like, terrible commitment phobia, and then she gets over it so quickly, you know? And so when I was writing my own, I thought, I'm going to do things differently. Mine's going to be more realistic, and it's not going to go down that same road. But then I realized that when you're actually writing one of these things, it's tough to get around that because you want to bring them together and you want the audience to care, but they can't just get together and that's the end. You know, there has to be some sort of problem. And then when that problem arises, you sort of want it to be something that's surmountable, insurmountable, but not too insurmountable. And then I want the happy ending, so I did the math and I realized that maybe I was just going to follow those who came before me. So, not take the road less traveled. And I would find smaller ways to deviate, but that central romantic comedy thing of get together, obstacle, get around the obstacle, happy ending, kind of set in stone in some ways.
So, one of the things that, you know, this is how everything is a story of a book, is a romance that, yeah, at the center of it. And I agree with that. And I would argue any great story that is not an act of romance has a romance subplot to it. So, the best, like, action movies, comedies, things that have nothing to do with, you know, the romantic category have a romantic subplot. And it's critical to your feelings and emotions. So my question for you is basically, is romance a strong enough topic to be the actual topic and core of what you would be writing about and the center of any story? Or is it actually best because it's kind of core to everything to be the underlying subplot with a main other plot on top of it that puts, you know, all the grand things happen?
I thought you were going to ask if Ben was like my husband. I guess there are, other stories where, there are other stories where the romance is a subplot versus the romance being the whole thing.
Yeah, being the main part of it, yeah.
Oh, I just didn't want to write about all that other stuff. Or comas, blah, blah, blah. Stick to the romance. Who needs the sadness? But you have some.
I think the if you're talking like A plot, B plot, I think the A plot of my book is the romance, and I think the B plot of it is sort of the everything else. But I think that there are tons of different ways to balance that. And I think that there are sort of don't know, like I feel like there are action adventure books that have romance pieces to them, and there are, you know, fantasy books that have romance pieces to them. So I do think just romance itself as part of the human experience is something that's so powerful that it can be part of any story, or it can be the main focus of a story, depending on the kind of story you want to tell.
I mean, I would just add that someone years ago said that when it comes to books, at least, that obsession is good, right? And he wasn't talking about romantic obsession, because I think at the time it was the orchid people, it was just anybody who, if you knew them in the real world, you might be a little spooked by them. But it triggers, I think, a feeling for some people, like, why is this other person so obsessed, either with this person or with this thing? But as far as, I mean, like, a week from today, millions upon millions of people will give each other red roses and chocolate, and some people will think that's the best thing that they could give that the other person could receive. And there are other people who think that it's very cliche, right? I mean, not to give away too much, but I mean, I heard something that the two of you early on taught me at this, that you're big hockey fans, yeah? Okay, and you're passionate Devils fan, yeah, and you're a Rangers fan, and that when the Devils play the Rangers, and I say,
separate rooms.
And that there's this Faustian bargain, but there's this bargaining about like which team's announcers. I heard the story. I just thought there was something very romantic about that. So I mean, that's a far cry from like red roses and chocolate, right? And I assume. Yeah, it seems like you take it very seriously, but it also seems like it's changed with a sort of playfulness that I think bleeds into being kind of romantic.
Yeah, I mean, the rules have changed over time. We've added provisions and specific details based on which team is winning and which team is higher in the standings. There's also a separate argument over, like, that involves who's the bigger fan, which is a less quantifiable measurement than the others, so that gets a little dicey, but yeah. Most people think when we say, oh, I'm a Rangers fan and my husband's a Devils fan, that means we watch together and give each other high fives, and then when my team loses, he consoles me and vice versa. But the reality is more like separate rooms. His team loses, everything's fine. My team loses, all hell breaks loose. I'm not nice to him at all for the rest of the night. Terrible sport, but that's romance in my household.
Jumping off from that concept a little bit, my husband loves romantic comedies, so I end up seeing a lot of them. I like them also, movies mostly, but I have a pet peeve about them frequently, which is that even in quite good scripting, the characters seem to spend a lot of time talking about their relationship. They're always saying, we've got to have that brunch so we can really talk about what's going on here. Well, the problem is, you're reminding me my father was dysfunctional, so, you know, it's like they're always sitting there out-psychologizing each other. And my husband and I always sit there and go, you know, this is charming, this is well-written, you know, people are nice to look at, et cetera. But, you know, we don't sit around talking about the psychology of our relationship. We sit around talking about Star Wars. Or we sit around talking about this movie. Or we sit around talking about, we met doing community theater. We always joke, the problem with these people is they didn't meet doing community theater. How does anybody meet if they don't do community theater? Seriously, we have a great meet cute, but, you know, it was not like, you know, it was doing theater. Like, people don't talk about their relationships in my personal experience. How did you, in your books, grapple with the cliches of the extent to which the characters are going to talk to each other about their relationships? If they're not going to do that, how are the dynamics of their relationships going to be made clear to the reader? And why does that come up so much in romantic comedies, that that's what they talk about, instead of interesting stuff that they haven't done?
I mean, I think one thing in my book, I think that you know that Ben really likes Eve, and it's not because he says that he likes her, he thinks that she's really pretty and nice and fun. she has this thing about her socks that she can't throw them away, like even if they have holes in them, because she's worried about what one sock would do without its pair. And at first, when Ben hears this, he's not like, that's so cute. He's like, that's weird. And also, you're always wearing socks with holes in them, that means, you know? But I think in the end, I don't want to give too much away, but I think that's her to him, is that sock thing, that weird sock thing. And so I think that is more realistic to me as a sign of affection than that someone who's really pretty and nice and smart, you know. That, to me, that's how it shows up more in real life. Yeah, I think I wanted the characters' kind of actions to speak loudly about how they felt about each other, what they did for each other, the lengths they would go to, you know, give someone what they wanted or not, or whatever. And then I also had the main character Lucy, talking to other people about relationships. So she talks to her best friend Kate and talks about how, uses these fire metaphors of like how a relationship could feel like a wildfire or a hearth fire or a bonfire or a sparkler. And she talks to her brother, who's a scientist, and he talks about different kind of chemical reactions, like clock reaction, the gummy bear experiment, or all these different things. So kind of using the secondary characters and then whatever it is that those people are interested in as a kind of way to bring in how they feel about different relationships.
One more question?
Can I ask what's next for both of you?
You first.
Sure. So I just handed in a draft of a new adult novel called The Shape of Our Words, which, if all goes well and my editor likes it, should be coming out in spring of 19. And I may or may not be writing a movie this summer.
Yeah.
So that's